This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. The prosecution in the murder trial of Alex Murdaugh has rested after painting a very damning picture of the accused. Over the course of 6 weeks, the prosecution presented more than 75 witnesses and 800 pieces of evidence, including documents, photographs, videos, and exhibits to prove that Murdaugh was guilty of killing his wife and son. With the prosecution's final say now given, the jury must weigh all the evidence and testimony presented to determine the guilt or innocence of Alex Murdaugh after the defense raises their final arguments. Let's head to the courtroom for the final segment today and the prosecution laying out their final arguments against Alex Murdaugh.
Or longer. Another matter we need to take up, so I was hopeful that we would, after he closes, we'd move to the...
And what do you want me, what do you want to ask me?
Well, I was just curious as, I was letting the court know how long my closing would be, and then if we went at 5, I wouldn't be done until 7 or 7:30.
You'll have an opportunity to fully argue at during a time where the jury's attention span won't be frayed due to the long hours.
And Your Honor, are you considering dealing with that other matter if we, for instance, adjourn? I think
yes.
Okay, because I think the Attorney General's thinking he's going to be done in about 45 minutes, but
how about less than that, Your
Honor? Or longer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Did you say you'll be done in how many minutes, or do you know?
I think less than 30, Your Honor.
Less than 30. Okay. I thought I heard 4 or 5. Less than 30. Okay. All right. Let's bring them in. Okay. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please record?
Sir.
DSR on the defendant's hands and seatbelt, Maggie's DNA on that Super Black Eagle, DNA on the Suburban steering wheel, no DNA or blood identified on the floorboards. Showing y'all state 7. That's the how you doing comment. And the second officer walks up, how you doing? States 5, also from the body cam. It's very dark out there. You can see how well lit it can be when the lights are on. 22. 93, 47. I'm almost done. Talk finally a little bit more about the defendant's story to you that he told on Thursday. We've already talked about it, just a couple more things. I asked him when he went down there, those dogs are clearly out in the kennel video. I asked him if the dogs were alerting on anybody nearby or in the woods, as dogs do. And he said no. He said that their dogs were not doing that. You heard about the fact that he changed clothes, and you also heard testimony that his clothes smelled fresh and like laundry. Is he again manufacturing the scene? You heard from his law partners that he was not, and also from Marion, that he was not overly concerned with figuring out what happened or any threats to Buster. And in fact, you heard in the telephone interview after the side of the road, they specifically asked him, are there any threats to Buster? And he said no. Why is there no threat to Buster? Because he was the threat to Maggie and Paul. He knows there's no vigilante out there. That's why he was never concerned about it. That's why he called Rogan first the night of. He knows the only threat is him. I asked him if he could remember lying to all of those close to him, people that he trusted, that he stole from. He couldn't detail one single conversation. He couldn't remember his last conversation at the kennels. To use his own words, and when you hear what he has to say, when he was asked after the kennel video and his new story, what he did, he said, I got out of there. He's got that photographic memory, but can't remember what he was doing when he was his most active on that day. He didn't say, if only I had been there. If only I had gone to the kennels. If only I could have stopped it. If only I had been there a little longer. He says, I got out of there. What father would hold anything back if he were innocent? What father would care what happens to him after that? He claims he told you that he had cooperated with SLED. But he hadn't. There's nothing more important if someone's innocent to telling law enforcement when the last time the victims were alive. I just saw them. I saw them at 8:50. I saw them at 8:49. They're still out there. Go get them. He mentioned paranoia and tried to convince you that there was paranoia about some case 10 years ago, and he confused David Owen with David Williams. He got on the stand, ladies and gentlemen, and as he got confronted with things, as he was allowed to keep talking, he kept adding a new factor and a new factor and a new factor to justify why he's lying to you, why he had lied to law enforcement, and to justify why he's telling you what he's telling you now. He kept adding them. He can remember those, ladies and gentlemen. He can remember a new one. He can remember this. And the problem with that is that there's no mistaking David Owen for David Williams. We showed you that picture of David Williams. This is a man who rides around with a badge in his windshield, who had blue lights installed on his private vehicle. And if you need any proof that he makes up lies and is very convincing with them and makes them up on the fly, he kind of got caught flat-footed with the badge hanging out of his pocket. He tried to assert to you that sometime maybe it was an accident, that this badge is hanging out of his pocket. How was that an accident? See how quickly he was able to lie? But more importantly, The blue lights. He sat there and told you three times, I think he said his name three times, that Sheriff Smalls, the former sheriff of Hampton County, gave him permission to put blue lights in a private vehicle for a part-time assistant solicitor. And blue lights in a private vehicle. He told you three times, effortlessly got up there, pivoted, and lied to you. Because Sheriff Smalls came in here and said, of course not. That never happened. I've never heard of such a thing. This is a man who made his trade on lying. He lied about the most important fact in the case, and he sat there and effortlessly and easily pivoted to a new lie when confronted with something he wasn't prepared for. And the sheriff came in here and said, no, that never happened. Of course not. But he looked y'all in the eyes and told you that. Looked you all in the eyes and told you that. As if, what's your problem, Mr. Waters? Sheriff Small said it was okay. He tries to tell you that he was paranoid about having a bag of pills in his pocket. The man who had blue lights in his car and had a badge, rides around with a badge in his windshield. That's what he thinks of his power and prestige, and that's what he thinks of appropriate use of authority, is to put it up there. It only serves him. It's only there to serve him. But he tried to also tell you that he gets paranoid, and so he's tried to lie about the most important fact that he could offer law enforcement when his wife and son were brutally murdered because he had a bag of pills in his pocket, but yet at the same breath says, I wasn't concerned about the law firm and that fair stuff. I'm not concerned about the boat case. Why would he lie about that time unless he's manufacturing an alibi? And that's just why it took him only 19 seconds to call 911, because he knew what he was going to find out there. This has all been constructed by him to try to confuse the situation. That lie that he told you, he tried to make it seem like he'd been trying to tell this, but he also admitted on the stand that, and as did his brother, that his own brothers heard it for the first time last week. That his own attorney was repeating the story that he was napping the whole time and never went to the kennels on HBO in November, just a couple months ago. A lot of people lie, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of people lie. When it's really important, something like this, this brutal murder, most people are going to come clean about a bag of pills. But why do people lie? People lie because they knew they did something wrong. That's why he lied, ladies and gentlemen. And just like always, when confronted with new evidence that he no longer can deny, he backtracks, he pivots, and he tells a new story from that stand and looks you all in the eye. And then when new evidence comes up on cross, he backtracks and he pivots and he tells another new lie. And I'm sure if he could get up there again, he'd be telling, well, let me rephrase that. He said so many witnesses are lying on him. They're all lying on him. But the one thing we know is a constant is that he lied to them. Mark Tinsley's lying. Jeannie Seckinger's lying. Shelley Smith is lying. Blanca's lying. Everybody's lying on the master liar. You heard him answer the questions about whether or not he killed his wife and son. You heard me ask him if he was a family annihilator. When he answers those questions, did you see him do this? Did you see him do that on those videos too when asked questions where now we know he was lying? Is that the most classic tell ever? I'll leave that to you to decide. One thing I will agree with him that he said up there, oh, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive. How appropriate coming from that man. This man is trying to sell you on an idea that he was at the kennels, that he jetted back, that he went inside so quickly and quickly dozed off on the shortest nap in the history of the South. And then he got in his car just seconds after these supposed vigilantes. These vigilantes that apparently are 5'2", that knew somehow that Paul and Maggie would be both at Moselle on the evening of June 7th between 8:44 and 9:02, that also knew that they would be alone at this time. That they knew that Alec would not be at these kennels. And they also knew the property well enough to get to the kennels. They also assumed that they would find ammunition and guns there, so they didn't bring those. And they traveled the same route as Alec after his short 20-second nap and knew that he would be visiting his mother at Alameda during that time. Those are the circumstances that you'd have to accept. The 5'2 vigilantes that arrived somehow in that tiny time period between 8:49 and 9:02, and that's given him every benefit of the doubt as to the story he told you, sprinkled with a bunch of new lies as well. That somehow they arrived during that time, the dogs never heard them or ran to them. Somebody put the dogs up in the wrong kennels. Somebody rolled up the hose. And these vigilantes were just lucky enough to find these family weapons there. Which he's clear on the other side of it that he says we're never there. He's so clear. Oh, we never had the blackout. We never rode around with the blackout. No one knew who he was. No one knew who this man was. He'd avoided accountability his whole life. He had relied on his family name. He had a powerful family. He carried a badge and used that authority. He lived a wealthy life. But now finally, he was facing complete ruin. His father, who he idolized, who I worked with on occasion, was dying. His son was facing charges for the boat case. He was facing a civil action that not only could potentially ruin him, but expose the reality of what he'd been doing for years. He had an opiate addiction. The entire illusion of his life was about to be altered. He couldn't live for that. He's the kind of person for which shame is an extraordinary provocation. Shame is an extraordinary provocation. His ego couldn't stand that, and he became a family annihilator. And I was thinking, that people who get the last word in this courtroom are y'all. And a lot of witnesses have testified over the last 6 weeks, but there's a couple that never get to testify, but are important, and that's common sense and human nature. And there's two more that don't get to testify. We couldn't bring you any eyewitnesses because they were murdered. But common sense and human nature can speak on behalf of Maggie and Paul. When you look at this in its totality, common sense and human nature can speak for them. And they deserve a voice. Everything he did was meant to try to frustrate the forensics as a lawyer and a prosecutor with the two guns and the manufactured alibi and not taking his phone down to the scene, deleting call logs, making short phone calls, bringing up the boat case, moving Maggie's phone, changing clothes, looking at Paul's phone, calling Rogan, or trying to call Rogan. One man controlled this crime scene initially, and that was Ella. But there were some things he couldn't control. And we brought those to you. A couple things that the defendant said that I agree with. He said, whoever did this had anger in his heart. Whoever did this planned it for a long time. That he hurt the ones who were closest to him. It may be hard to fathom, ladies and gentlemen, that when you put all these circumstances together and really understand who he was in the entirety of his life, and the pressures that he was facing from what he had been doing for so long, you can understand it. There was one mistake, though, he didn't expect. And this is why he was worried about Paul's phone. This is why he's trying to get in touch with Rogan. And it was that kennel video that came up late in the investigation. One of the things I asked him talked about this, the last question I had to him, and the first question I had to him was, what is the most important part of your testimony here today. And he wouldn't even concede that. But he at least conceded that the most important thing was to look you in the eye and try to explain to you why, after his entire history, you should believe him when he says, okay, I was down in the kennels for one brief minute, but I had nothing to do with this. We went through that long cross in which he identified all these factors, from his partner saying having an attorney, you need to have an attorney present, to his distrust of SLED, to Dave Owen asking him about his relationship, and asked him, at what point did you decide to lie? And he finally agreed, okay, it was in this interview, it was that moment in the June 8th interview. It was during that interview. But in his 911 call, ladies and gentlemen, at 10:06, when he was asked when he last saw them, he said an hour and a half, and then changed it to approximately 2 hours. Consistent with what he would later say. Before any of those factors that he sat there and ran through with y'all is the reason for his decision even ever existed. And if that's not enough, ladies and gentlemen, you saw, and I played it for him, Daniel Green's body cam, where he was asked the same question. And he said that it was 1.5 hours plus 45 minutes. And all those factors that he identified to you as to why he supposedly lied, he was lying to you, ladies and gentlemen, when he made those up. He was lying to you when he made those up, just like he's lied to everyone close to him. And he's good at it. He's good at it.
It was earlier tonight. I don't know the exact time, but
okay.
I left. I was probably gone an hour and a half from my mom's, and I saw them about 45 minutes before that.
Okay.
I rode around with Paul.
Motive, the means, the opportunity, and ample evidence of guilty conduct and guilty conscience. All four factors are present. Maggie and Paul, deserve a voice. They need a voice because they can no longer speak. And this has been a tough job. But the system depends on people who take that oath as jurors and are willing to honor that oath and make that tough decision to vindicate
these victims, to vindicate Maggie and Paul, who were cut down in the prime of their lives. This is a sealed exhibit. This is what he did. This is what he did right here. This defendant, on the other hand, has fooled everyone who thought they were close to him, everyone who thought they knew he was who he was. He's fooled them all. And he fooled Maggie and Paul too. And they paid for it with their lives. Don't let him fool you too. On behalf of the state of South Carolina, I ask you to return a verdict of guilty against the defendant, Richard Alexander Murdoch, for the murder of his wife, Maggie, and his son, Paul, and for his possession of firearms during the commission of those malicious offenses. Thank y'all for your attention during this long trial.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that will be it for this day. We'll resume at 9:30 tomorrow morning. If you go to the jury room, and you'll be dismissed in just a few minutes from the jury room. And we'll please do not discuss the case at all with anyone, including your fellow jurors. We'll recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning, except for the matter that we will address in chambers with counsel.
That's the latest that we have for you right here. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage in the trial of Alec Murdoch. Tomorrow, the defense laying out their final arguments as well, and then the decision goes to the jury. I'm Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod. Be sure to press subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage. Stay with us.